Okay, welcome back. I've been trying to think for several hours. Somebody very kindly sent me an email this week and said, by the way, someone who was talking, and I believe the subject was UFOs and ETs. Someone has put out a UFO ET video, and you're in it. And I said to myself, I'm not what? I haven't been in anything. Not lately, long, long ago. He says, no, you're in there for a long section, and there is absolutely no mention of who you are or where that soundbite came from. Nothing. Well, just example number, 20,000 and something over all the years and how many people have taken things from the program. And I don't really lose sleep over it. I can't. It's too much. But the idea that the information is getting out to people, that's kind of a, you know, it's a prize. It's not the main prize, but it's a good thing. But people steal all the time. Now with AI, I wonder if AI is even giving credit when sources are quoted by AI. I don't know. I just don't know. It opens a lot of doors. The bottom line is there are very few honest researchers and writers out there anymore who don't take other people's material and rewrite it or pitch it into AI and ask AI to rewrite it. Now, I'm not joking. They'll do it and give it back to them in a brand new format. Make it look like no one's ever seen this before and take from X, Y, and Z and weave it in there. And AI can do it in a matter of seconds. So we are living now in a world that is not good. But when you run across people who aren't AI and they're stealing from you and they're not giving you credit or attribution, this probably will be our last chance to complain and really raise hell about it, because everything's moving into a world of science fiction now that in another 5 or 10 years, if we're all still here, you won't be able to tell anything from anything. It'll be all... It's like you can no longer see and depend on your sight. You can no longer hear and depend on your hearing because it can be so easily concocted out of nothingness. AI, again. We're already in that. And look how quickly. 2 years ago, we weren't talking like this. Now we are. Two very extraordinary people are going to be with us the next 2 hours. And it's really great to spend time with them whenever I can. Don Schmidt and Tom Carey. Without Don and Tom and Kevin Randall, we would know next to nothing about Roswell. We would know very little about ET involvement with our military, how things are covered up. We wouldn't know how the government threatens people with their very lives, threatens to kill them, and may have killed people over the years to shut them up. I think we have ample evidence of that. If you just follow the news, you'll see it. So let's find out about Tom and Don and what's been going on. That something happened here that is kind of reminiscent of what I told you in the beginning, that I'm in a video, and I'm not in the video, but I sure am in the video, and nobody bothered to mention where that information and that soundbite came from. So let's welcome back Tom Carey first. Hello, Tom. Are you there?
I am here, Jeff. Nice to be with you.
Thank you, sir. Donald, are you there?
Of course. Great to be back with you again, Jeff. Thank you.
Yes, yes. How did your dress rehearsal go last night? Tom is a performer, an artist, and he had a big dress rehearsal for a performance. I'm just curious. How did it go?
Well, my voice was back after a week's bout with laryngitis, and as you recall, yeah, last Thursday, Jeff, I was yeah, pretty off key, so to speak. But yeah, with two concerts coming up this weekend, I'll be all ready. Thank you.
Good, good. You're welcome. All right, gentlemen, where are we here now? Don wrote to me about an instance of, I could call it plagiarism, I'll just call it theft, and that's what it is. Plagiarism's a nice word for theft, and it's just disgusting, no matter how you phrase it, actually. Tell me what happened, Don.
Well, this actually would even predate the manner by which we've been treated numerous times, specifically by News Nation. you know, has been, you know, in the forefront on the UFO topic. Yeah. And have afforded, you know, many an individual, without going into names, you know, they are their go-to people whenever it comes to this particular subject.
Yeah.
And, but yet they fail to really engage Roswell. And in fact, I was called one particular evening that you need to tune in to News Nation. They're doing an entire segment on Roswell. And as one would predict, neither Tom or I were involved. And the whole thing was slanted towards the official government position that this was nothing more than a mobile weather balloon and nothing more to see here.
Wow.
Well, I immediately contacted the news editor there, and her response was, "Well, we've moved on, so we have no intention of readdressing this subject."
Oh, we've moved on. I see.
We've moved on.
Sounds just slightly condescending and arrogant, just a little.
Precisely. And Tom and I have dealt with that, you know, probably more than anyone in the field. That
probably.
They like to think that they're the authorities just because they've dabbled, you know, on the subject here and there.
Yeah.
And so I was speaking at a one-day conference down in Illinois, and somebody comes up to me and says, "What's with your buddy Rodiger? He just claimed that there were no bodies recovered at Roswell." And he was talking
if I might just say that I don't know who Rodinger is. It's new to me too, but Tom,
you're not
yeah.
alone.
No,
well,
I hear you. But he has he's got a following. I have heard of him, but
he
never
is
so
the scientific
briefly.
Director, president of the Center for UFO Studies, specifically
Kufos.
The J. Allen Center for UFO Studies, so he, you know, he was heir to that throne, so to speak, and he was with both Tom and I at the very beginning in the sense that they served as an oversight committee. You know, we would report back from the front lines whenever we would be in Chicago at the Kufos office, and they were all, you know, anxious to hear, you know, our recent exploits, you know, down in New Mexico. And, but all was with their official response as to, well, are we going to believe this, or are we going to dismiss this, or, you know, how can we write these witnesses off because, you know, Tom and Don, they're just not, you know, providing us with the evidence. I mean, we're getting a lot of anecdotal information. We're getting a lot of firsthand testimony, but nothing that we're going to, you know, achieve fame and fortune from.
So I want to make sure everybody got that. Who just said that you quoted? Who made that statement? Tom and Don don't come up
with
anything.
It was just more of a composite, you know, remark on my part.
But, because it's true. It's
and Tom
the
would
way
agree.
That's how they discount you, of course.
Right, right.
It's a collective.
That they always had the last word. Tom, I want you to please jump in anytime you'd like. But, in fact, even right now, I mean the way they treated you even.
Well, Don is bringing up a lot of bad memories of when I was on the board. Don was on the board of directors. He resigned first, and I resigned after him. It was
Kufos.
Kufos. And we would go to it was in Chicago, Illinois. And they had an office. It was in a real estate office, what a place that was. We have different memories of that. It was at the end of a long hallway, and
that's bizarre. Excuse me. That is bizarre. You were actually trying to conduct QFOS business with sharing a building with a real estate office. That's weird.
Yes,
that's
and it weird. Wasn't it wasn't like state of the art either. It
was
it was at the end of a long hallway.
Yeah.
And Don was the lead Roswell investigator, and everything he said was true. But after he resigned, I became the lead Roswell investigator. And what they would do, you've heard of armchair investigators, right? Well, they were just dropped the investigator part. They were just armchair pontificators. Mark Rodiger had a PhD, I think, in sociology or something
like that.
That's correct.
That's correct, sociology, yeah.
Yeah, and the other fellow, Michael Swords, had a PhD in, I don't know what it was, history or something like that.
Okay.
And my feeling was that they looked down on us as inferiors trying to do a job. Now, we would go down to Roswell, we would go to New Mexico, we would go to California, we would go to Texas, we would do all of the
at our own expense, no less.
Yeah.
Yes, it was at our own expense, and we would get to, they had two meetings a year, one in the spring and one in the fall, and they were all anxious to hear about Roswell, but all they did was criticize us. Oh, did you do this? Did you do that?
At the risk of sounding trite, they were jealous. They weren't doing anything. Of course they're going to knock you. You're blowing them out of the water. That's just my observation
here, but I
don't know how else to look at it. Go ahead.
They had this other fellow who also had a PhD, and all they did is he had an interest in UFOs, but because he had a PhD after his name, he was, you know, better than us.
Yeah, I get it, right.
And I just had a belly full of them. Michael Swords would start talking. He would never shut up. And I would go between falling asleep and getting a bad headache. And Mark Rodiger is conducting the meeting, and there was this woman whose name I can't remember. I'm sure Don remembers who she was. Well, she hated Roswell. She absolutely hated it, and the only reason she got to attend the meetings was that all of the files and all of the stuff was stored in her apartment. So the payoff was, well, she could attend the meetings, but all she did was criticize, and it wasn't constructive criticism. It was, what have you guys been doing? You're not proving anything. You know, it was
nasty
stuff.
Nah,
and fortunately, I forget her name, but I'm sure Don remembers her name. But
yes, I do.
If I remember, she had red hair, if I remember. And there was this other fellow there. He was, I don't know what he was doing there, but he was attending. And Jeff, it was just I had a belly full of it.
But they only had meetings twice a year, you're telling me.
Yes.
Is that correct?
And what caused
Board meetings, yes.
But still.
What caused me to finally resign was that Mark Rodiger said, Tom, I'm going to be in Philadelphia. You know, I live near Philadelphia. I said, Tom, I'm going to be in Philadelphia in a few months. I'll look you up because we can talk then. He says, I'm working on a lead. So what happened was he got this great lead. He went to Philadelphia. He never looked me up. He gave the lead to somebody else. And I'm the lead Roswell guy for QFOS. I never knew he was in Philadelphia, but he came and went and gave the lead to somebody else. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But he was an airline pilot for Delta. The
late Bob Durant. Bob Durant.
Yes, that's who it was, mm-hmm. And that was for me a big show of disrespect. And I
mouth. Come on,
I submitted my resignation. Once I found that out, and never looked back.
Good. Well, neither one of you have any reason to look back. Look what you've achieved. You've given the world Roswell. I don't mind saying it. It's my take.
And Jeff, the main reason that, you know, I emailed you and asked if both Tom and I could have, you know, this opportunity was that here is the director of KUFOS. He's being interviewed by Ross Coulthart, who, you know, is an internationally known journalist who is now devoted and committed as far as, you know, all of his efforts as far as to, you know, total disclosure on the UFO matter. And Mark, who, again, was our scientific director in the past, and that he essentially then is representing us in that capacity, and Coulthart would bring up Roswell. There is no acknowledgement of either Tom or myself from Roediger. He speaks specifically about what he has done regarding Roswell. And then to make a blanket statement that based on such a cursory examination of our investigation, he states that there were no bodies recovered.
I watched that show today, Don and Jeff. I watched it because I wanted to know what you were talking about. And I wrote a few notes about it, of the several things that really upset me. Well, that I noted. I don't listen to Mark Roediger. I could care less what he says about anything. But on this show, Roediger says, here's the things that really bugged me a bit, is the body thing. He said there were no bodies. Are you kidding me? How many witnesses, Don, do we have that spoke about bodies, starting with Edwin Easley?
No, thank you for putting that in there. These are first-hand accounts.
Precisely.
It's not hearsay.
And deathbed.
It's not hand-me-down.
And deathbed. And
deathbed,
you know what
confessions.
And you know what their explanation is? For someone like Colonel Edwin Easley, who on his deathbed confesses that there were bodies recovered at Roswell, they were lying. They were
Here's
lying.
So,
yes.
Okay. Now, what we're talking about, if you joined us late, is a video.
I have another good one here.
a video of a program, an interview between Mark Roediger and Ross Coulthart. Now, this is absurd, and it's almost beyond belief absurd that they would do that and say these things. What the hell is wrong with people? Please go ahead, Tom. Forget my question there.
Yes,
just
we have. I counted them up. We have 30 deathbed confessions from our investigation.
And how many do those two gentlemen have between them?
I would say zero.
Zero, yes, that would be my guess.
How many UFO cases have 30 witnesses, let alone 30 deathbeds? Now, the one really upset me a bit was Mark Roediger said that he was involved in exposing Frank Kaufman. Now, Don, I don't remember when you and I were down in Roswell visiting with Frank Kaufman on his deathbed, dying from cancer.
Repeatedly,
I must have missed Mark Roediger. Please tell me if I just missed him and he was there secretly.
Well, he would have been there in a subsequent trip that was shortly after Kaufman's passing. And as you would recall, Tom, when I found the satchel of all the forged documents in Kaufman's office that were stashed under a drawer in his desk, Roediger was there.
Oh.
And you recall that then it was Kevin Randall, and then Roediger wrote the story.
But we had already confronted Kaufman on his deathbed.
Yes.
We had already done that. We said, Frank, why did you do it? And he said, well, it got out of hand. Oh, that's just great, you know. But we had already broken the story. Well, we didn't publish yet, but
the deal was, and I forbid them from saying a word until Kaufman's wife, Juanita, mm-hmm. had passed away.
Yes.
In other words, why would we in any way ruin the reputation of her husband, you know, when he was not there to defend himself, and that it should be the last memory she would be provided?
Oh, well
done. Husband. So,
oh, absolutely.
So there
well
again,
done.
We were being professional.
Perfect. Yes,
respectful.
Totally. Yeah.
But he,
100%.
Roediger, had nothing to do with exposing, other than the, I think he gave it to Kevin Randall to publish something on it. But we were the ones that actually confronted Kaufman, because everybody, you know, he gave for a couple of years, he was sort of the, you know, the king of the hill there. You know,
star witness.
Yeah.
I remember when he was one of the last of the big ones, right?
I wouldn't say the one of the last, because even, and Tom would certainly remember when we had confronted Kaufman, even in the late 90s, and we hit him with some details that we had unraveled. And one was specifically a coded message that he claimed he received, you know, from some source in Washington, and it was in code, and it was 146E, something like that. And we were sitting at breakfast with Kaufman, and thank God he was close to a wall, because all at once Tom and I hit him with, Frank, tell us about that old Methodist hymnal, or hymn called Thou Wilt Comest From Above.
I thought it was going to faint.
Yeah, because that was that its number is, it was listed in a hymnal, was 146E. And it just happened to be the title of that spiritual song. Yeah. And
so
Frank tipped back on his chair against the wall. And like Tom said, we thought he was going to faint. And then he came back and he leaned forward and he pointed at us and he went, damn, you guys are good.
I would have paid to see that one.
Not according to QFOS. We just weren't doing quite the right thing.
Look, the point of all this, what we're doing here, is that there is a right way to do things and a wrong way. And there are truths and then there are lies. And we're trying to simply put out, in the face of this telecast, broadcast, video, what really happened, what really went on. And I think that's important for journalism, for people, for ethics, for our culture.
You know,
we can't let these things slide. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I watch, you know, the Travel Channel does a lot of UFO stuff, so does the History Channel, but they never interview us in depth about Roswell. It's always, you know, and
I don't get it. That's the most important. I would say, if I had to point to one, they keep talking about Tic Tac, Tic Tac. What the hell? Tic Tac.
Yeah.
That's nothing compared to Roswell, in my view.
Yeah.
Plus, that's nearly 20-year-old video.
Yeah. I like Nick Pope. He's a friend of mine. Same with
nice guy.
Rich Dolan, you know, we're not, you know, we're friends, but they go to those guys, but they get their stuff from us. They get their stuff from us. And
call on Rich and Nick for firsthand or top quality expertise
Roswell. How about Roswell? And it's, you know, and you know, Nick Pope, he's a friend of mine, and my goodness, they get their information from us. And some of the stuff, I'm sure Don recognizes our stuff like I do. I'm thinking, my goodness, it's like we don't exist. We don't exist.
I don't understand that, unless I would suggest there may be a possibility that you're too good and you have been kind of blacklisted. They don't want to give you the notoriety you deserve. It's possible.
That is a consideration, and I'll cite a couple of quick examples. Like in mentioning that it was Ross Coulthart who did the interview with Roediger for News Nation.
I see. Right.
And Coulthart did a documentary. He came from Australia. They did a documentary. They went to New Mexico. You would think they would have then included Roswell, given they were in New Mexico. You know what the case they did? You know the case they did?
No.
It was Aztec.
Oh, come on.
It was Aztec. They did Aztec, but they wouldn't do Roswell. And the excuse I received was, well, it wasn't in the budget. Okay.
No. They don't have your guys. Oh, please.
And the thing is, Coldheart was the one who broke the story with the non-whistleblower, David Grush. He's not a whistleblower. He's secondhand. That is not a whistleblower. But in recounting Roswell, it's always some farmer that discovered the wreckage. And then they flash on the screen the pictures of Jesse Marcel with the weather balloon and the radar reflector kite. That's not the actual wreckage, but they still always suggest that it was. And Coldheart would make the comment, well, though it's true that most people do accept the mogul balloon explanation.
Oh, really?
And that is not true.
On what planet is that?
In fact, when Kevin Randall did ABC Nightline, they did a phone-in poll that they revealed the results the next night with Ted Koppel, and it was like 87% said they didn't believe the government's explanation on Roswell. So it's like, who do these people really work for? Who are they running interference for?
I don't think that that could be accidental, Don, that what they're doing. I just don't.
And they then got, Coldheart, I immediately boundaries. Contacted him.
Yeah.
I contacted him about the interview with Roediger. And it's like, well, how come you never talk to us? I mean, you do things
it on
Roswell, but you never talk to the authorities.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
You never get any ink, as they say. No airtime. And you deserve mountains of it. We shouldn't dismiss the possibility that you're off limits, both of you, because you know too much. You got 30 first-hand witness accounts, at least. Is that the number?
Just deathbed.
Each one admissible
in a court of law.
Yes, I got you. So if you're speaking to anybody, most especially someone in the media, they would jump through hoops to get that kind of evidence and information. I would, from you people, but you're not anywhere. You don't get any notice. Here, we very gratefully have you on both once a month, but where else? Where else are you being given any recognition? I'd like to know.
The other thing that bothers me is that we have co-authored 11 books together on this case alone. Now, Don and Kevin did 2 books. Don and myself did 11. And we've had lawyers, doctors, educators saying that if we ever took a case like this to court, we would win hands down. There's no doubt about it. But it's like our books don't exist. It's like they don't exist.
No, there's no coincidence here. I smell it. They quietly tell people, well, interview this person, that person, but stay away from Kerry and Schmidt. Don't go there.
For whatever reason. And not to sound.
And don't worry about it. You don't.
We are experiencing sour grapes. That's not all.
No, of course not.
You're not going to get away with making such a pronouncement when Tom and I can demonstrate witness after witness, case after case, deathbed testimonies that say, yes, indeed, there were bodies recovered at Roswell.
Yeah. And what was the quote again, Tom? Coldheart said in this interview program, what did he say about bodies? Which one said it?
Oh, Roediger. He asked Roediger about bodies, and Roediger said he didn't believe there were bodies. I would be interested in learning why Roediger believes there were no bodies when we have so many witnesses to do that fact. And
that's one of the most solid pieces of the entire Roswell story.
Yes.
That there were bodies. So yes. I don't find that believable that he could actually think that
if
way.
If you would allow me to suggest.
Go ahead, Don. Yeah.
And for them, and Tom, we've often discussed this, the idea that no matter how exotic, how bizarre the wreckage, you could still make a case that it was something beyond our known technology, something that we were working on. You could still, make a case that it was something of our own technology, our own design. But the moment you start talking about non-human bodies, all bets are off.
Right,
I mean,
now,
there then is only one explanation. And it's like all of these journalists, these representatives in Washington, or in this case, a scientist, that their fallback still remains, well, we still don't know if it is really off the planet. And we're only, we limit it to something that deals strictly with wreckage and only wreckage. The moment they concede bodies, they have completely, demonstrated that.
No, the case goes to an entirely different level, the top level, instantly. It's gone.
The other thing, Jeff, is that they don't consider testimony as evidence. Well, in a court of law, credible testimony is considered evidence.
Sure.
When they say evidence, they mean a physical piece of the wreckage. That's what they're talking about, which we do not have. We readily admit that. But they say, there's no evidence. I say, well, what about testimony? Well, that's not evidence. Of course it is. If you have testimony and corroborating testimony and more corroborating testimony in a court of law, that is considered evidence.
30 deathbed confessions. I can't believe that. And you both should be featured at this point in multiple History Channel specials on Roswell. Why Roswell is the foundation for all modern ufology? Because there were bodies there, and all the eyewitnesses that have been diligently found, interviewed, documented, they're all in the books, 11 books plus two more, 13
and
books.
And all of the witnesses say there was one still alive.
All of them.
I would say 99% say there was one still alive. How long it lived, we don't know, but there was one that survived the crash. And
without you guys, you have nailed it all down tight. There's no wiggle room anywhere. It's there. You've done it. We know what happened. Go ahead.
Let's just, as we even, touched on him briefly earlier in the program, at the time, Major, but Edwin Easley, he's the provost marshal. He's in charge of all base security at the Roswell Army Airfield back at that time. So he would have been involved in every capacity of that entire recovery, that retrieval operation, and he certainly would have known about the bodies. And it was when we located him down in Texas, and then when Kevin Randall made the phone call, and it's recorded, and this was in 1990, so 43 years after the incident, and Easley is stating over and over again, I can't talk about it. I'm still sworn to secrecy. He's then a lieutenant colonel, retired, but he is stating that he is still sworn to secrecy. He wouldn't acknowledge anything. And a year later, after we had sent him a copy of the first book, and Kevin and I are together, and we're talking to Easley on the phone, and we asked him what his thoughts were regarding the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he made comments that were very positive. But he still wouldn't admit anything. So then Kevin threw, you know, the perfect ringer, which was, well, Colonel, you see the direction we're going. Can you at least tell us if we're going in the right direction?
Yeah.
And easily in perfect military, you know, protocol responds, well, let's just say you're not going in the wrong direction.
Oh, what a classic.
And we had multiple chapters in that book already recounting the testimony regarding the body. So it wasn't like, accept this chapter or that suggestion or that witness. No, you're not going in the wrong direction.
Great little story.
A few years later, when Easley is dying, he's at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah.
Parkland Hospital, where John F. Kennedy was pronounced dead.
Mm-hmm.
And in the presence of his two daughters, and one of them, Mary Strickland, who is a retired now, but then a practicing attorney, Easley's granddaughter approaches him at his bedside in the hospital room, holds it up to his face, and he turns away and goes, oh, the creatures.
Holds what up?
Well, it turned out to be a copy of our book.
Oh, okay.
And that was his reaction. Oh,
and he'd give us a reaction again.
Creatures.
The
creatures. Not the weather balloon, not the crash test dummies. Oh, the creatures. And again, how do you just summarily dismiss such a situation? Family.
No,
he is on his deathbed. They would immediately tell another doctor there, who Tom and I both know, Dr. Harold Granick.
Mm-hmm.
So he heard it immediately as well. And that's just one. And so that's what boggles our minds in that it's not even a case of cherry picking as much as let's just dismiss all of them because either I'm doing as I'm told or I have to be the scientific director and I have to sound the authority.
Let me suggest this. If anyone is listening, and there probably is someone who's in any way tied into the History Channel or what's the other one, Tom, the Travel Channel?
Travel Channel, yeah.
Yeah. You're sitting on found gold here with these two gentlemen. There should be a a three-part series. 10 deathbed confessions recounted in each of the three parts of this series. You would have a fabulous find of information that no one even talks about much anymore. That it's right there, and that's just one aspect. You got deathbed confessions. You could do another section on the bodies, all the stories about the bodies. This is solid gold that is not being mined. You should have these gentlemen on a series at least on the deathbed confessions. That's just my idea of how it would be.
Tom, just allow me to interject one more thing quickly. When we did the Roswell movie, and Tom was also there with us on the set we were filming in Bisbee, Arizona, just east of Sierra Vista.
What year was that again? I can't remember.
It was the fall of 93.
Yes,
November,
just before I started this program. Just before I started it. Yeah.
And we're nominated Best Made for TV Movie, Golden Globes Award.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a Showtime production. This was the only movie in the history of Showtime that was ever nominated for a Golden Globe. And you would think that we could have marched right in after that award situation and okay, how soon can we do a sequel? Because we're still working on the case, we're still hot on the case, and we have even more information. They didn't know us from Adam. It was like the door was slammed, don't ever bother us again.
Now you're blacklisted. There's no doubt. You know too much.
And when the film, when the film came out on video, it was the number one requested film on military bases all around the world. And guess what happens? The video is pulled off the market. You couldn't get a copy of it. And then a few years later, when the DVD came out, exact same reaction on the part of the military, and that was pulled off the market. And so there's a pattern here.
Yes, there is.
And but Tom and I, we have often said, if we weren't getting this reaction, we would have long wondered if we were over the target.
Correct. No, no, you're right there. There's no other way to look at this. It's just, it's beyond pragmatic. You guys should have 10 major one-hour programs on one or both of those networks at this point. It's not too late. This is a bonanza, especially with all this TikTok stuff. I am not impressed with it. And wasn't it, Tom, 2003 or 4 when this first video of the TikTok that was released was actually recorded? It was a long time ago.
Boy, you got me there, Jeff.
Yeah, it would be 2004.
It goes back.
Yeah.
Was it 2004? All right, I'm correct. It's old stuff, in other words. When they rolled this out, I said, why now? This is old material. Why are they making such a big deal out of it? Misdirection. That's why. I mean, about it. If we had 3 1-hour in a series of death, Roswell deathbed confessions, the real people who were there, the real officers and men sworn to secrecy, who were from a different era, you could paint the whole story. It would be a magnificent three-part series. Just write that. Right there.
The most recent deathbed, Jeff, is happened last month.
Yes.
We received.
Another one.
Yes. And you gave, just for your listeners, you gave Don and I a lead on this, a pilot. Who was stationed at Roswell, who I tried to interview 30 years ago.
Yes,
Jeff.
Yes.
30 years ago, and he basically told me to get lost. And but he's in the yearbook, and he was a pilot there. And so I, it was out of my mind for now 30 years until your email last month.
One of our listeners, and thanks again to him for that email. It was very helpful.
So I first interviewed the listener, and he turned out to be quite a fellow. He worked for Northrop Grumman Aircraft as a template designer for fighter planes. I mean, he was pretty technically oriented, and he knew this pilot. He was a next-door neighbor of this pilot. I can give the name. His name was Bill Harrison. He was a retired as a full bird colonel, and he was a co-pilot to Woody Swancutt, who was the top B-29 pilot back then at on the base. And I interviewed the son about a month ago, but I re-interviewed him last week for about an hour. I recorded it, and
very good.
I'm going to write that up for you and Don with what we talked about. And our source got the story about his the son's father from the son of the same name. Bill Harrison, this was Junior. And turns out that over the years, whenever the son, he knew that his father was at Roswell and was a pilot, but he himself did not believe the Roswell story because his father would never talk about it. And when he would ask his father about it, he would say, well, who, I can't talk about it. Who will take care of your mother? And he said, I don't know what he means by that. So that went on for years until the pilot, former pilot, Bill Harrison, he tripped and fell at home and landed on his back down by the swimming pool of this townhome complex where our source stumbled upon him, literally, and called an ambulance. Should I get the ambulance? Yes. And so he helped Bill until the ambulance got there, and off he went to Parkland Hospital in Fort Worth. Wow. I'm sorry. I guess Parkland is in Dallas.
Dallas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this would be a local hospital in Fort Worth. And so Bill said he couldn't get up. He had fallen and hurt his back. And turns out in the hospital, he came down with pneumonia, and he was on his deathbed, and the family was there. And he said, folks, now he's on his deathbed, and he knows it. He says, folks, everything you've heard about Roswell is true, 100% true. The wreckage, the crash, the bodies, everything is 100% true. And that's where our source, whose name is Lane Crabtree, he said I could use his name, Crabtree lives in Texas. And the son had lived in Hawaii for a while, but he moved back to Fort Worth. And he got the story from the son, and he said, I never believed in it, but my father said it was all true. So, and since I interviewed him the first time, Jeff and Don, he bought a copy of our book, Witness to Roswell, 75th anniversary, and read it. And he said, oh, my goodness, you guys, I am certainly convinced now, and I know what my father went through. Because he said his father had been visited over the years by fellas in the, you know, higher ups in the Air Force. And he just thought, oh, well, they're here to check some of his benefits for retirement or something. But they would go off in another room. And the year 2000, his father received this letter, official letter from a JAG officer in Washington.
Which is a lawyer,
Yes, and Harrison had been retired since 1972, but he had several high-paying jobs, high-profile jobs in the Defense Department, et cetera, et cetera. But he received this letter in 2000, in the year 2000. It said, basically threatened him that if he ever spoke about Roswell, he would lose his benefits, including the benefits for his family, his wife. And so that's what he meant when he told his son, whenever
the
son asked,
who will take care of your mom? Yeah.
Yeah, who will take care of your mother? And so he died in 2003 at the age of 83. And, you know, the son never came forward until, Lane Crabtree had that, stumbled across his father who was injured. And so who he then called you, and you sent the email to us. And this is how we get our leads sometimes. So I interviewed the son the first time. It only lasted, maybe 20 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. And I called him up because he had a part in his story that I had a problem with. I said, what else did, you know, I had asked him, what else did your father say? He said, well, he said he told me that at home there's a closet that's under lock and key, and inside the closet is all my memorabilia, including a little metal box that itself is under a lock and key. So I'm thinking, here we go.
Tom, can you hold that thought? We have to take a break. We'll come back.
Good place.
You set
good
it
place
up
for
perfectly.
A break.
No one's going to go away. The metal box itself under lock and key. This is good. I would pay to see a 3-part series on deathbed confessions. I would pay, like a movie, to see it. Because it's true.
We agree.
How often do you get the truth anymore? For God's sakes. All right. We'll be right back with Don and Tom in just a few minutes. Hang on, and we'll find out about that little metal box next.